From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, the architects of war. To understand the war in Iraq, we have to go back to the run-up to the war. Remember all the talk about WMDs, Saddam Hussein's links to 9/11, Yellow Cake in Niger? The war in Iraq was a preemptive strike to save us, we were told, from Saddam's imminent threat. Here's neoconservative Richard Pearl in a 2003 interview with Steve Paulson.
Now, one of the complaints, the criticisms that a lot of people who opposed the war against Iraq voiced was the morality of preemptive war. Iraq had not attacked us. What do you make of this as a moral issue?
Well, I think it's a practical question and not a moral question, although I'm perfectly happy to defend our Iraq policy on moral as well as practical grounds. I'm sure you would agree, and the people you're referring to would agree, that if we saw a missile being erected on a launcher aimed at the United States and we had the capacity to destroy that missile on its launcher before the countdown, we would be justified in doing that. In fact, we'd be irresponsible and negligent if we didn't do it. That's an act of preemption. It's also an act of self-defense. Do we have to wait until the missile lands on our territory? What is the right moment when the requirements of self-defense justify our acting before we are struck? And I think that can only be answered in the specific context of the specific situation. But on moral grounds, it seems to me, if we can protect the lives of our citizens by acting preemptively, the president has an obligation to do that. We're right to do that.
That's what neoconservative Richard Pearl said before the war started. But that was 2003. In light of all we now know, do neoconservatives still support their pre-war arguments justifying the war in Iraq? We asked Douglas Feith, a leading neoconservative intellectual. He was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the number three position at the Pentagon, serving under Donald Rumsfeld. Feith was one of the architects of the Bush administration's war on terrorism. He's also been a lightning rod for controversy and was investigated for allegedly distorting pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Steve Paulson talked with Feith about decision-making in the aftermath of 9/11.
One of the common criticisms that you hear over and over is that there was tremendous goodwill towards the United States right after 9/11. There was great sympathy to what happened in this country. And then that seemed to go out the window with the war in Iraq. That generated all kinds of anti-American sentiment, especially in Muslim countries. And certainly you can argue that it has provoked many more terrorists to join al-Qaeda and other organizations than there were before that war.
I'm familiar with that argument. I'm not sure that it's correct. I'm not sure that we'll know until we get a bit down the road whether that's correct. It's a complex question. What are the trade-offs of different kinds of activities in the war on terrorism? And we were conscious of the fact that certain kinds of activities to respond to the 9/11 attack might generate more antagonism in the short term, but if they demonstrate that the Islamist extremist cause is actually being set back, it could persuade people that it's not worth fighting us. I think a lot of these questions are hard to answer as we're still in the middle of the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, this war on terrorism has also come at a steep price. I mean, not just in dollars and the lives of soldiers and civilians in the Middle East, but also in the civil liberties of people. American citizens have had their phones tapped. Innocent foreigners have been, on occasion, seized and even thrown into prison without recourse to due process. Do you ever wonder if the price is too steep?
It's an important question that troubled people in the administration from moments after 9/11 occurred. There was a recognition after 9/11 occurred that we were going to have to make some changes in the way we operated, and we're going to have to re-examine the trade-offs between civil liberties and public safety. I mean, I know that there are a lot of people who've criticized the administration as if the administration were full of people who were rubbing their hands with glee saying, oh boy, 9/11 gives us an opportunity to cut back on civil liberties. But that's a ridiculous caricature and completely false. I mean, in fact, my experience with people in the administration was that people were by and large focused on the difficulty of taking effective action to prevent follow-on 9/11 attacks and recognizing that some of the actions we're taking were going to change this balance between civil liberties and public safety. It was a very well-known phenomenon in American history that when public safety is undermined and people feel threatened, the government generally takes measures to provide safety, even at the expense of some of the civil liberties that everybody would much prefer to have in place when there's not that kind of danger.
Right. And I think most Americans would agree with that, certainly right after 9/11, that there was this kind of need. I mean, this was such a horrible thing that happened. But do we still need this kind of curtailment of civil rights? And, you know, the kinds of things that we keep hearing about, secret wiretapping of phone calls or a black ops budget that's estimated at $27 billion, though we have no idea what the money is actually being spent on because there's no public record of it. I mean, I guess the point is...
Well, I think it's a good question to ask. I mean, I'll give you an example of what I mean by a trade-off of civil liberties and public safety. We had barriers erected between the FBI and the CIA for civil liberties reasons, where we said that they can't share information. And after 9/11... it was understood that one of the problems that put the government in a position where it couldn't deal as effectively as possible with the kind of threat that hit us on 9/11 was that foreign intelligence couldn't be shared with domestic law enforcement people. So people said, look, given the kind of danger that we faced and that materialized with the 9/11 attack, we should knock down this wall, this barrier, that prevented the sharing of intelligence with law enforcement people. Now, that's an example of how you kind of redo the balance.
Which makes sense in a lot of ways. We've certainly heard about how there was such territoriality between FBI and CIA. It also does mean then that the CIA might go into the business of spying on American citizens.
And those are dangers. And one of the things that I said was very much at the fore of people's minds and was a major topic of conversation among many of us after 9/11 was, if there had been a series of 9/11 type attacks, there would be enormous pressure for the United States to adopt tougher and tougher measures, police state type measures. If there were a series of 9/11 type attacks, you could imagine the kind of clamor for intrusions on privacy, for inspections, for possibly racial profiling, and all kinds of other measures that the public might demand if it felt as vulnerable and exposed as people tended to right after the 9/11 attack. And part of the concern that I explained that we talked about among ourselves, among officials after 9/11, was that there's something of a ratchet effect often when it comes to setting certain civil liberties aside in favor of greater safety measures, that even when the threat recedes, you don't always have the full restoration of privacy and civil liberties. And one of the things we were concerned about is that the very nature of our society as a free and open society could be undermined if there were a series of 9/11 type attacks.
Looking back on your work in the Defense Department, what are you most proud of?
I think that the strategy that we developed after 9/11 that aimed at preventing the follow-on attacks that we feared would come was actually an important and sensible strategy. And we have not had another attack, a 9/11 type attack in the United States. And, you know, one can never exactly say what a cause and effect are. I think that our strategy contributed to this result, and it's an important result. And I think if you had asked most people on September 12th, 2001, you know, what chance would you give that 6.5 years later we would not be hit again? Most people would have not given it a very high chance. And I think that the development of that strategy and the vigorous prosecution of it were a contribution to the country.
Douglas Feith is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He's the author of War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism.
These are among the most dangerous, best-trained, vicious killers on the face of the earth.
They're terrorists, they're bomb makers, they're facilitators of terror, they're members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
And if they were free, they would engage in murder once again.
Well, the only thing I know for certain is that these are bad people.
it is a mean, nasty, dangerous, dirty business out there, and we have to operate in that arena. But we need to make certain that we have not tied the hands, if you will, of our intelligence communities in terms of accomplishing their mission.
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
After the 1991 Gulf War and America's 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, many news outlets complained to the Pentagon about not getting access to the battlefield. The Pentagon responded with its embedded media program, the program where journalists are stationed with U.S. troops. One of the architects of the embed program was Marine Colonel David LaPan. I caught up with LaPan during a hectic day at the Pentagon. The writer Joseph Nye has referred to the military's ability to leverage the media through the embed program as the weaponization of reporters. Are embeds military weapons?
I don't agree with that characterization. I believe that the Department of Defense did have a vested interest in having the story told, but we also recognized and stated good, bad, or ugly. And our idea was ultimately the good would outweigh the bad and the ugly, but that it was warts and all, tell the story. There was also an element of understanding from Afghanistan and also Iraq from past practice that propaganda and disinformation by our enemies was prevalent. And the best way to counter that was to have an independent journalist on the scene to report fairly and accurately what was going on. So there was a recognition that by having reporters there, again, not to spin or to promote the war, but just to tell it from that first-person perspective, would do a lot to undermine the enemy's efforts to sway the world with disinformation and propaganda. And we saw that in Iraq with, you know, some of the press briefings that came from Baghdad, where the Iraqi government was claiming one thing, and embedded reporters were, you know, hundreds of yards or a few miles away saying, that's not the way it is here.
So it's been effective, you think? I mean, this has worked pretty much as the Pentagon hoped it would in Iraq?
I think so. I think, again, overall, the Department of Defense believes that it was effective. Again, there were instances of problems with it on both sides. It wasn't something that was perfect. It wasn't something that was going to come without some level of friction. And there's also, I think, this sense that it's not the be-all and end-all either, that it in many ways was an improvement over past practice. But in the future, it may not be the best way to do business.
Because you've talked about the things that have worked as far as the Pentagon is concerned. Are there negatives about the embed program? Are there things that, from the Pentagon's point of view, have gone wrong?
I don't know that I'd characterize it as gone wrong as much as because a lot of these things were expected. Like I said, we knew that we were going to get warts and all. I give the example of one of the successes of the embedding program having resulted from an incident involving Marines in which civilians, innocent civilians, were killed. And people think, wow, how is that a success? And it's that very nature that things are going to happen in war that are not pretty, that are not the way we'd like them to be. But that embedded reporter was able to provide the full context of that particular incident. He had been traveling with this unit. He understood the threat from the insurgents who don't wear uniforms that aren't clearly discernible as combatants, that were using vehicles as bombs. So that reporter understood the threat. He understood the environment in which the Marines were forced to make life and death decisions. He witnessed the event as it took place. He witnessed the steps taken by the Marines to try to resolve the situation short of using deadly force, then having to rely on deadly force. And almost as important, the fact that once the Marines involved discovered that they were women and children who were killed, the remorse that they felt. And it painted what we think was a very accurate picture of a very unfortunate circumstance.
One of the benefits of the embedded media program, at least according to Dan Rather of CBS News, was that he says it, in the early days of the war, it silenced the anti-war movement in the U.S. He said all of those embed reports focused everybody's attention in this country on the men and women who were fighting there and made support the troops the thing that everybody had to do. Do you think that's right?
That's an indictment of the news organizations. It was very clear, again, from the beginning that embedding was just one way in which news was going to be gathered. I think it was incumbent upon news organizations to seek many different perspectives, understanding that their embedded reporters were seeing a very tiny slice, now a very up-close and personal and one that couldn't be obtained in other ways, but yet a very small slice of an overall battle. And I think it was, again, the responsibility of news organizations to report from Baghdad, to report from Central Command headquarters in Qatar, to report from here in Washington or New York or anywhere else, and to kludge all of those different perspectives together to inform their readers, their listeners, and their viewers as to what was going on and not just rely solely on the reports of embedded reporters.
It's clear that there are benefits to the Pentagon as a whole to have embedded journalists who not only can see exactly what's going on, but are able to report on exactly what's going on and present the soldiers' point of view. What does it mean for the commanders in the battlefield? Do they worry about having non-military personnel in their units, and especially reporters who are going to tell exactly what happened?
That is certainly the case. There were, I'm sure, a number of commanders that probably did not like or were uncomfortable with, you know, however you'd phrase it, the idea of embedding.
They wish they weren't
to them
there.
It was added responsibility. Yeah. Here is a person in my military unit who has not trained with us, who is not, you know, a Marine or a soldier or a sailor or an airman, who may or may not be physically fit, who doesn't carry a weapon for good reason, but who's unarmed on the battlefield, and I'm responsible for him or her.
Well, you know, at the end of this, you look at it and you say the embed journalist program, it was an experiment. It was something that hadn't been tried, at least at this level, before. Do you think it's here to stay?
I do, to some extent. Again, we made it very clear early on that it wasn't one size fits all. In a future conflict, it may or may not look like what Iraq did. And embedding may or may not be the solution. But I think the element of the embedding program that will be with us is that understanding that providing access to the maximum extent possible serves both news organizations, the world of journalism, and the military, and ultimately the American public.
David LePan is the Director of Public Affairs for the U.S. Marine Corps and one of the architects of the Department of Defense's Embedded Media Program. Have any thoughts about today's show? Send us your comments at our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground. Coming up, one of the architects of the 2007 troop surge in Iraq.
The answer to IEDs, IEDs are roadside bombs, the answer to IEDs is not to drive around in ever more heavily armoured vehicles. The answer is to convince Iraqis not to plant them anymore and not to tolerate those who do plant them. So we had to look beyond the IED to the social network that was responsible for placing it.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, The Architects of War is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. David Kilcullen says most counterinsurgency efforts fail because a foreign army simply galvanizes opposition from the local people. These locals join the insurgency not as ideologues. They just want to defend their land and their customs from the foreign invader. Kilcullen calls these locals accidental guerrillas. It's also the title of his new book. Now, Kilcullen's no dove. He's been an on-the-ground military officer in Indonesia, East Africa, and the Philippines. He's also been an advisor to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and was a top military advisor to General Petraeus during the troop surge in Iraq. He's currently an informal advisor to the Obama administration in Afghanistan. Kilcullen told Anne Strainchamps that the accidental guerrilla makes up some 90% of a typical insurgency.
I looked in detail at about a dozen conflicts around the world that are currently happening. And what I found was that in each case, there's a very small proportion of people that we're engaged in fighting who are genuine enemies of the West who would be coming after us regardless of whether we were there or not. But the vast majority of people, numerically and in terms of the number of incidents, are what I call accidental guerrillas. They're people who are fighting us primarily because we're there. They're fighting us because we went to their valley or their village or to their country to deal with this very small enemy group. And so there's a real threat out there, but actually a lot of the people we're fighting don't belong to that threat group. They're people who are pushing back against us coming into their environment.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I use an example in the Afghan chapter of the book about a big firefight in Oruzgan province in May of 2006, where a Taliban group ambushed a U.S. Special Forces patrol, and the patrol was pinned down for about 6 hours in the bottom of a valley because local villagers who'd been working in the fields went home, got their weapons, and came back and joined in the fight. And after the fight, we talked to people and said, well, we didn't think that you supported the Taliban, so why were you shooting at us? And they said, well, we actually don't support the Taliban. But, you know, this firefight that just happened in our valley, this is the most exciting thing that's happened here for 10 years. And it would have been dishonorable for us to sit that fight out and not take part in it. And if you're going to take up arms and be part of a fight, you're not going to intervene on the side of the infidel foreigner. You're going to intervene on the side of the Afghan. So we felt like we had no choice. And there are countless other examples in the book from Iraq, southern Thailand, Indonesia, the Horn of Africa, Pakistan, a variety of other places to demonstrate that this isn't, you know, the US's fault. It isn't anything to do with the nature of Muslim society or backward society. It's just human nature that when you wade into somebody else's local environment and start smacking heads together, you generate a response, which is a backlash.
Let's talk about how some of these ideas played out in Iraq. You were the architect of the general framework for General Petraeus' troop surge in 2007. Why didn't that troop surge create thousands more accidental guerrillas?
That's exactly right. You know, extra troops can be a good thing or a bad thing. And the numbers of troops were not the cause of success in Iraq in 2007. It was what they did when they got there. So we previously had been adopting what I would call a repetitive raiding approach, where we would surge into an area, chase the bad guys, kill as many as we could find, do a significant amount of damage to the local population in that process, and then we'd sit there for a while and we'd try and talk people into being part of our sort of development programs and governance programs and so on. And most people would be too frightened to engage, but a few would come and work with us and take part in those programs, and they were generally the sorts of people that supported the international community. And then after a period of time, something else would happen somewhere else, and we would pick up and leave. And of course, then the enemy would come back and kill those people. And so what we were actually doing was systematically killing off all the people in the Iraqi society that were willing to work with us. And we'd go back to that environment again, and we'd say, hey, where are all these people we worked with last month? Well, they're dead. And now their neighbors don't want to work with you because they just saw their next-door neighbor's head get cut off for working with the counterinsurgency forces.
In fact, what we were doing for all of our goodwill is we were destabilizing the area.
That's right. And chasing the enemy actually has a destabilizing effect in a lot of cases. And what we did during the surge was we decided to stop doing that. And we went in and we partnered with the population, and we had a lot of explaining to do, you know, and we had to sit down in most cases almost on the first day of moving into a new area and have a discussion with the local community. And it usually went something like, listen, we're really sorry about what happened. We're planning to stay this time, and we are going to protect you, and we're going to put that first. And let's make a deal on how we together are going to protect your community. And generally the response was, we don't believe you. You know, you've come and gone so many times. How come this time is going to be different? And we would have to convince them over a period of time that this time we were serious.
How did you do that after they'd been burned so often?
Well, partly by actually getting out and living in the environment with them. I mean, we'd never really done that before. We'd had units on the ground, but we'd had this kind of repetitive raiding mentality. So we'd shoot our way in, dealing with the enemy, and shoot our way out. Instead, we actually moved into their areas and we took out, you know, 10-year leases on buildings and established these local security stations that were more like police stations than military bases. And then we started to develop a relationship with people. You know, when I went there the first time in 2006, a special forces guy said to me, I've never met an Iraqi who wasn't in handcuffs. And basically those guys had no interaction with the Iraqi population. And so the Iraqis didn't see us as people they could do business with. They just saw us as strangers who turned up in their district in a heavily armored metal box and shot a few people and left. What we had to do was establish the relationship with them and actually live in the district so they knew who we were, they recognized us by face, they actually knew our names, and we could build a relationship with them to the point where they gradually got enough confidence to start pointing out the enemy in their midst.
You've got some really telling descriptions in your book of what it was like to just move through the streets in Baghdad or another Iraqi city before the surge and then after. I wondered if you could describe that. I think beforehand you're talking about moving through the city in these very large, heavily armored vehicles, in which didn't one of your colleagues called them armored submarines?
Urban submarine, yes. Steve Misker, who was the deputy brigade commander of a brigade in northwest Baghdad and a great guy who really understood this stuff, he said to me, look, this is an urban submarine. You know, what we've done is we've separated ourselves from the people and they don't actually see us as human beings anymore. And, you know, General McChrystal, who's now commanding in Afghanistan, was also there in Iraq at the time. And he said, look, the answer to IEDs, IEDs are roadside bombs, the answer to IEDs is not to drive around in ever more heavily armored vehicles. The answer is to convince Iraqis not to plant them anymore and not to tolerate those who do plant them. So we had to look beyond the IED to the social network that was responsible for placing it and try and attack that network and reduce its ability to cooperate with the local population.
But doing that meant doing things that seemed counterintuitive. For instance, you're taking a bunch of troops and saying, okay, we're going to go through the city. It's extremely dangerous. The death toll is very high. Now, instead of sending them through in armored vehicles, you said, no, we're going to go through one at a time, just person by person.
Right. It's counterintuitive. That was my main job over there, was helping people get over that hump and helping them understand how to do it in such a way that would actually be safer, even though it seemed more dangerous. You know, I worked with one unit in northern Baghdad, which had been there for 6 months already, and they'd lost almost 50 people. All of those people, they had lost commuting to the fight. They used to live outside Baghdad in a forward operating base, a FOB, and they would drive in every morning to their working area and drive home every night. And every day they'd lose somebody going up and down the road. And they'd come to see the whole city as hostile and everybody in it as an enemy. And that just made them pretty ineffective in doing their job. And it also meant they'd get more people killed because no one was willing to help them to understand the environment. When we started to reorient, they were terrified of the idea of getting out of the vehicle and actually walking and being on the ground and living with people. Once we showed them how to do it and held their hand for one or two attempts and they actually got out and started doing it, their casualties rapidly started to drop. And they realized within a week or two that it seemed dangerous, but it was actually safer. And in the last year of their tour, they only lost two people. And both those people were killed in their working environment by the enemy, as distinct from randomly on the side of the road getting to work in the morning.
Looking back now, would you say the surge in 2007 was successful?
I would. I think a lot of people are saying, well, things are getting bad again, so the surge didn't work. But see, that actually makes the point that it did work. If you do something and the environment becomes 95% safer, which is what happened, and then you stop doing it and the environment gets dangerous again, well, that shows you that what you were doing was working. But I think the problem is that as we pull back, we are inevitably going to see a rise in violence in Iraq. But the question now is, will the local Iraqi institutions and the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi government be able to handle that violence without our constant presence? Mm. And that's a question that we really don't know the answer to. So I think we're going to see violence go up, but we really don't know yet whether it's going to get to the levels of 2006, which might require a re-intervention.
You know, speaking to that, I want to read you a quotation from General Odierno, the current commander of coalition forces in Iraq. Speaking about the surge, he said, "The surge did create a breathing space, but to our surprise, Iraqi leaders used it to move backward rather than forward, and all the surge may have done was kick the can down the road," suggesting the surge might have been a military success, but a political failure?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm on record, and I've said this a number of times. I think that our fundamental failure in Iraq, as in Afghanistan, all along was political. We went in there without a viable political strategy. We had this so-called nation-building or state-building agenda, but we never figured out what kind of a state we were trying to build, and we never decided on how to get there in a political sense, really until about 2007 with Ryan Crocker and a new political approach. And there was a lot of hard work done by people in the embassy and a lot of, and this is not anything to do with the State Department guys on the ground. It was back in Washington. People just didn't think the problem through. And to my mind, that was a political failure. And saying, well, it was a military success, but a political failure, I think it's apples and oranges. You know, the military were failing in 05, 06. They were failing to deliver basic security. And we had to fix that. And that's what we did with the surge. But that's part of the problem. It's not the whole problem. We basically got ourselves out of a hole that we should never have been in the first place. And now we're back to the same old problem of how do we build a viable Iraqi state.
David Kilcullen speaking with Anne Strainchamps. Kilcullen's the author of The Accidental Guerrilla, Fighting Small Wars in the Midst of a Big One. Kilcullen was a top military advisor to General Petraeus during the troop surge in Iraq. He's currently an informal advisor to the Obama administration in Afghanistan. Ali Alawi spent almost 3 years in the center of power in Iraq. He was Minister of Trade and Minister of Defense in the interim Iraqi Governing Council from 2003 to 2004. Alawi then served as the Minister of Finance in the Iraqi transitional government until 2006. He resigned after getting too frustrated by the Iraqi government's infighting in the transitional government. Steve Paulson sat down with Ali Alawi.
During Saddam Hussein's years in power, you were a prominent member of the opposition in exile, living for the most part in England. Back in 2002, did you support the American push to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam?
Well, I mean, in 2002, it was becoming clear that the United States was practically on an irreversible course to invade. I must say, personally, I was skeptical because nobody really wants to see one's country invaded and occupied. It's not something that you would choose willingly, even if you're in mortal contest or combat with the regime in power. But my problem was that it was linked to what I thought were insufficient reasons to invade and occupy, namely the search for weapons of mass destruction and the war on terror. If it had a straight ethical content to it, in the sense that the United States finds it abhorrent or the international community finds it abhorrent that a state can commit such levels of repression against its own people and can cause such instability in the region, it had to be removed. That would have been, I think, a much better and more sound argument for invading a country, the ethical argument.
When did you realize that this war was not turning out the way the U.S. government had hoped for?
When I went back to Baghdad to join the government, I decided to keep a diary, really. And looking back at my diary entries, in October 2003, I made a personal jotting that this project is going to fail.
This was only half a year after U.S. forces went in. Already then, you realized this was a failure.
Yes. Well, this was half a year after the fall of the regime, but it was also only about 8 weeks after I became a minister that it became clear to me that the telltale signs of failure were there.
Why? What were the most obvious failures?
Well, the incoherence, the inappropriate administration, the mismanagement, the quality of people who were sent to administer a country about which very little was known in the United States, the tensions between the occupying administration and the Iraqi counterparts, both in the governing council and the cabinet, the low quality of people who were chosen to run the country, including, I might add, Iraqis. A lot of them were just incorrect. They were the wrong people in the wrong place. The whole thing just did not make sense to me.
What's been the biggest surprise to you about what has happened since the coalition invasion in 2003? What did you simply not see coming?
What I underestimated, and I think many people underestimated, was the virulence and the violence used. I thought that after a few weeks, maybe months, of resistance on the part of the Sunni Arab community, they would somehow adjust to the changeover and accept a diminished status in the context of the formation of a non-sectarian state. But that didn't happen. Instead, we had a very, very violent response.
Why do you think that didn't happen?
I think because the invasion really upended centuries-old power relationships. What happened after the war was that the empowerment of the Shias was seen to be a complete disempowerment of the Sunnis.
Yeah. Now, you have had very much an insider's perspective on Iraq over the last few years. You've been part of the post-war governing coalition, first as Minister of Defense between 2003 and 2004, then Minister of Finance between 2005 and 2006. And along the way, you have made some interesting personal choices, such as choosing to live outside the Green Zone in Baghdad. Why did you do that?
For the most prosaic reasons, because my house is there. My family house is outside of the Green Zone. So I prefer to live in my own house. But with that said, I really wanted to also make a point. I mean, I didn't want to live in a cocoon, a fortress-like cocoon, where you have all the, you know, creature comforts and power is uninterrupted and relatively safe and all of that. But you're completely disconnected with the rest of the country. But there were negative consequences of that. One of them is that wherever I had to travel from, let's say, my home to the ministry, you had to be very carefully on guard against ambushes and assassins and so on. And
well, wasn't your convoy ambushed twice?
My convoy was ambushed twice. Once it was really a very serious affair. We were attacked in a square by shooters who were around buildings around it, something the equivalent of sort of Times Square in New York, the Baghdad version of it. Another time I had stopped my convoy for lunch and some of my guards went out to provide lunch for the security detail. There's about 60 of them.
60 people in your security detail?
Yes.
Wow.
They were attacked by a suicide bomber. So I lost 3 of my guards killed to a suicide bomber and 6 very badly wounded. That obviously shook us up considerably. It's a frightening, well, terrifying experience.
Yeah.
To just watch it. So it became increasingly unsafe. So this symbolic gesture also had its costs.
Ali Alawi was Minister of Trade and Minister of Defense in the interim Iraqi Governing Council from 2003 to 2004. Alawi was then Minister of Finance in the Iraqi Transitional Government until 2006. During that time, he survived 2 assassination attempts. Alawi's book is called The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Coming up, our exit plan from Iraq.
Do you think a civil war in Iraq is avoidable? It's not. It is inevitable. Just because you get up and walk out of the movie doesn't mean the movie ends. I think Obama has been slow to recognize just how screwed he is in Iraq.
For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, The Architects of War is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
Not so fast, says the Washington Post's Thomas Ricks. This 2-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize ends his latest book called The Gamble with the following sentence. The events for which the Iraq War will be remembered probably have not happened yet. If the U.S. has any chance of winning the war in Iraq, Rick says, we have to understand we came dangerously close to out-and-out losing it. The date was November 19, 2004. It was a Saturday in the town of Haditha, some 150 miles north of Baghdad. Rick's told me that Haditha was the low point of the war.
It really showed the bankruptcy of going after the enemy in Iraq without regard to the civilian population. The Marines at Haditha, in which 24 Iraqis were killed, didn't consider it a significant enough event to report it up the chain of command. There's a formal thing called a significant action or a SIGACT. And Haditha, with the killing of 24 Iraqis, was not on the SIGACT report that day.
It's even too bland to just remember it as the killing of 24 Iraqis. It was a determined house-to-house pursuit of civilian Iraqis, including women and children.
It was. The Marines firing the weapons knew they were killing women and children and an old man in a wheelchair as well. They were looking at these people as they shot them. General Corelli, who was the number two guy in Iraq at the time, was stunned not only that the Marines didn't report it, but when he asked about it, he said, well, just give me the details on the investigation. He was told there is no investigation. And at that point, his jaw dropped. 24 Iraqis are dead, many of them civilian, women and children, and nobody thinks it's significant enough to even look into this. To him, that really sent a blinking red light that the troops and their commanders were not understanding how to go about prevailing in Iraq.
So when did we begin to go wrong? This is not something that happened only on the street level. It did go up the chain of command, and not just up the chain of command of the Army, but also, as you say, beyond the Pentagon to then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, to the Joint Chiefs?
I think the thing was wrong from the start. Now, I have an opinion here, or a view, that the invasion of Iraq was the single biggest mistake in the history of American foreign policy. It was a blunder. We invaded a country preemptively on false premises. So I think everything is poisoned by that. We went into Iraq on the wrong foot. If you invade a country on false premises, you think you're doing these people a big favor. They don't think so. You think you're liberating them. Very quickly, they came to see us as occupiers. And there was a constant clash in what we thought we were doing there and what Iraqis believed we were doing there. And I think it's only when we took a big time out, stepped back, and revamped the entire mission that there began to be any consistency, that we got off that wrong foot that culminated in Haditha.
And as a result of that mistake when we went in, it was what you were just talking about. It was that we didn't see the primary mission as protection of the Iraqi people. There was something else, and I'm not even sure anybody knows what it was anymore.
Well, when we went in, after going in under these false premises, the U.S. military did what it historically and typically has done. It focused on the enemy. And that's very much a conventional view of warfare, in which you see it almost like a football game. We're playing the other team, and civilians, those are just the people up in the stands, never understanding that the fight is actually for control of those people. So we went in totally focused on killing and capturing the enemy. If you remember early on, they had those deck of cards, the 52 leaders under Saddam they were going after. There was a total focus on that. And so when commanders would round up tens of thousands of military-age males and ship them off to Abu Ghraib or other detention facilities, they saw it as a net plus if in that big roundup they captured a few so-called bad guys. The big exception to this back in 03-04 at the beginning of the war was General Petraeus, who was then up north in Mosul commanding the 101st Airborne Division. Now, Petraeus is an unusual general, has a PhD in international relations from Princeton. He actually did his dissertation on the Vietnam War. And Petraeus laid down some rules early on for his guys. One of them was, and a major one, was don't make any more enemies than you need. The second one was don't do anything that creates more enemies than it stops. And this was a bit of common sense logic that was lost on a large chunk of the U.S. military early on. So the military recovered those lessons, but it took a surprisingly and agonizingly long time to adjust. By the time we started getting effective on the ground in Iraq, we had been in Iraq longer than the U.S. military was in World War II.
So we're really talking about this period between 2005 and 2007, when the military began to look at what had gone before, began to look at what Petraeus had actually managed to accomplish in the early days of Iraq, and began to think about applying it to the rest of the war.
That's absolutely right. 06 was a crucial year in this war. In 06, two things are going on. In Iraq, the war is going downhill very fast. It's become a small civil war in central Iraq. The American commanders have thrown in their forces twice, what they called Operation Together Forward 1 and then Operation Together Forward 2, trying to reassert security in Baghdad. Both operations failed. And by the end of the year, the Pentagon did a secret study that formally concluded and explicitly stated, we are losing this war. Simultaneously in 06, General Petraeus is back at Fort Leavenworth writing a new counterinsurgency manual for the U.S. military. Now, this manual is at once quite a scathing critique of how the U.S. military and the U.S. government have operated in Iraq. It is also a blueprint for how he would operate in Iraq were he given the job of top command there.
So this was adopted as a policy that ought to be pursued. What happened when Petraeus got there? What was the reaction of the boots on the ground?
There's a lot of skepticism at the outset of the surge, and I think rightly so. People here in the United States never really understood just how violent and difficult the first 6 months of 2007 were, the beginning of the surge. It was a very rough time. For several months, American casualties went up and got quite high, up to a couple hundred, I think, in May and June each of 2007, with no sign of an improvement in security. And it was kind of a near-run thing. There's a lot of skepticism around Petraeus Nodierno about whether this new approach would ever work.
So when was the turnaround?
The turnaround in the tactical situation, that is to say, the improvement in security, began in the early summer of 2007. And at first it was a trickle, first noticed by the small unit leaders, the lieutenants commanding platoons, the captains commanding companies. They'd say, you know, there's a different vibe on the street. People are talking to us more. We're understanding things more. One guy said, the locals still won't tell us where the bombs are, but on our patrols, when we go out right at dawn, sometimes we see spray-painted circles along the side of the road. Somebody has pointed out for us, without talking to us, where the bombs were planted last night.
So here we are later. Your first book was called Fiasco. You use the word advisedly, talking about what you thought about the first few years of the war. Does this mean, now that you've written The Gamble, that you think the surge wasn't a fiasco, that the surge worked?
The surge was not a fiasco. It improved security. But judged on its own terms, the surge failed. The purpose of the surge, as laid out by the president and his secretary of defense, was to improve security in such a way to create a breathing space that would lead to a political breakthrough in Iraq. That breakthrough has not occurred.
Do we have a U.S. policy, a U.S. strategy for Iraq now? And if so, what is it?
I think we do, but I think it's over-optimistic. President Bush didn't invade Iraq and said, I've got a great idea, let's go to Iraq and get stuck for 10 years. He said, I know what we'll do. We'll invade Iraq and we'll get out quickly. The original war plan was to be down to 35,000 troops by the fall of 2003. President Obama comes into office and says, I've got a great idea. Let's get out of Iraq quickly. We'll be down to 35,000 to 50,000 troops by the fall of 2010, and the combat mission will end. Well, just because you hang up a mission accomplished banner on an aircraft carrier doesn't mean the mission is accomplished. Just because you call it a non-combat mission doesn't mean the combat's going to end.
At the end of The Gamble, somewhere you write, the events for which the Iraqi war will be remembered by us and by the world have not happened yet. That's maybe the most disturbing thing you've said.
It actually was said to me by Ryan Crocker, who was U.S. ambassador to Iraq during the surge, and a terrific diplomat and a very honest man. He said it to me twice. He said it to me first in January 2008, and in my last interview with him, in November of 2008, I said, look, if you still believe this, I want to check, because if you do, I'm going to use it as the last line in the book. He said, not only do I still believe it, I believe it more than ever. Crocker is a relative optimist on Iraq. He thinks its future is going to be like Lebanon. may not sound good to you or me. We wouldn't want to live there, but an improvement over where Iraq is now. But he is at the optimistic end of the scale. At the other end of the scale, I gave a speech recently to a bunch of American officials, and at the end of it, a leading American expert on Iraq inside the government came up to me and he said, Tom, you are so over-optimistic. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you think a civil war in Iraq is avoidable. It's not. It is inevitable. Just because you get up and walk out of the movie doesn't mean the movie ends. I think Obama has been slow to recognize just how screwed he is in Iraq.
And maybe the administration that just left is glad to be out of town?
Yeah, also because they can say, well, when we left, you know, all the trend lines were good in Iraq. Security was improving, and you guys blew it. I don't think so. I think what they did was buy themselves a pause by cutting a lot of deals that improved the situation in the short term but might have created long-term problems. Number one in this category is the turning of the Sunni insurgency. General Petraeus did something astonishing. He put the Sunni insurgency on the American payroll. Nearly 100,000 fighters were paid $30 million a month to stop fighting the American presence. Now, I think it's a good deal. $30 million bucks is what George Steinbrenner pays for a mediocre second baseman. So I'm glad that they did it. The problem was that the Iraqis really never signed up to it. As one Iraqi politician said at the time of the deals, baby crocodiles are cute, but you can't keep adult crocodiles in the house. And the view is that we were feeding baby crocodiles left and right. Then we're going to get out of Iraq, and those crocodiles will have grown, and they'll be snapping at the Baghdad government.
The Washington Post's Thomas Ricks is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the author of the books Fiasco and The Gamble, both about the war in Iraq. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called The Architects of War. It's part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. This series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strange Champs, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Claire Radomski, and Madeline Mahon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Original theme music for Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground.
PRI, Public Radio International.